Hello and welcome to the Wake Up Call podcast. Today we're speaking with Dr. April Kelly Wessner about whether millennials are tolerant. Dr. Kelly Wessner is professor of political science and chair of the Department of Politics, Philosophy, and Legal Studies at Elizabethtown College. She is a co-author of The Still Divided Academy, How Competing Visions of Power, Politics, and Diversity Complicate the Mission of Higher Education, and contributed to The End of the Experiment, The Rise of Cultural Elites, and the Decline of America's Civic Culture. She is also the author of the article, How Marcuse Made Today's Students Less Tolerant Than Their Parents. Her blog posts can be found at heterodoxacademy.org. For more information, please see the show notes page for this episode at wakeupcallpodcast.com/tolerant. April, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So we're going to start with just a few basic definitions. What do you mean by millennials, and what do you mean by political tolerance?
It's a really good question. I'm not sure that I've ever used the word millennials when talking about the people that are in college today. So really, we're just talking about young people. We're looking at people in their, late teens, early 20s. And the question of tolerance is a good one and definitely requires some definitions. So when people talk about tolerance in the media, when people talk about tolerance in a general sense, they often just mean that people are nice to one another, right? And a lot of times people have declared that young people are more tolerant because they seem more open and they are much nicer to groups of people that have been historically marginalized, right? So I saw an article in The Economist, for example, that declared young people are more tolerant. And they cited, as an example, their acceptance of gay marriage, gay rights, as an example of this tolerance. That's really not what political scientists and political psychologists mean by tolerant, right? And so we have measured tolerance going back, several decades, looking at how people treated each other during the McCarthy era. And so the first measures of tolerance were about how people treated communists during that era. And what we mean by tolerance isn't who you like or whether or not you like people that used to be marginalized. What we mean by tolerance is how do you treat and how do you extend basic democratic rights to those people that you most fundamentally disagree with, right? And so when we talk about decline in political tolerance, what we're talking about is a decline in the willingness to allow free expression, free participation in democracy to whoever it is that you find dangerous. And so the groups of people that we are intolerant towards changes over time, right? We are no longer intolerant towards communists, but we might be intolerant towards other groups, and that's what we're seeing.
Sure. Can you go into some deeper conclusions that you reach in your research and explain how you came to those conclusions?
And actually I was somewhat surprised by them, and so it wasn't what I had expected to find, because since the first studies of political tolerance, which were Samuel Stauffer's studies during the communist era, since those studies, what we have seen for decades is a trend where people were becoming more and more and more politically tolerant over time. And as the nation became more educated, we saw levels of tolerance rise. And so earlier researchers concluded that this trend would just continue and that we would become more and more and more open to free expression, open to ideas, more tolerant of people with different perspectives participating in the democratic process. What we have seen is that that trend has now, for the first time since we started measuring it, it has reversed. And so we see, the oldest generations, people in their 60s and 70s are not very tolerant. And then people in their 50s are a little bit more tolerant, and people in their 40s and 30s are a little bit more tolerant. And then we see this reversal now where for the first time, the youngest people are not the most tolerant. So, you get this nice little, arc in the curve where tolerance is declining for people in their 20s now. It's lower than it is for my generation.
And so what are some of the groups that you claim young people are less tolerant towards?
The two big ones that come out are, first of all, they are intolerant towards racists and people that would have, racist sentiments, anti-black sentiments. And you might argue that's a good thing. But they're also much less tolerant of radical Muslims and people that preach radical Islam. And I think there's some misunderstanding about the way tolerance works. And people tend to think, well, if you're just intolerant of the bad people in society, then maybe that's not such a bad thing. Maybe we should be intolerant of racists and sexists and people that treat others poorly. But what we see is that those things are actually correlated with a general level of tolerance in a way that you might not expect just based on somebody's political ideology. So it just so happens that the people that won't let people with racist views speak on campus, those are also highly correlated with not allowing people to preach, Muslim ideas on campus. And so what tends to happen is that people try to apply a measure of consistency, right? And they try to say, well, what's fair is fair. If I'm not going to let these people talk, then anybody who offends anybody shouldn't have a right to talk. And so it's not just a question of silencing kind of the groups in society that you might argue we want to silence. It transcends that, and people end up silencing all sorts of different groups, including some of the very groups that they are aiming to protect.
Right, and in my experience, when we say that young people are less tolerant of racists or sexists, in some cases that we're actually talking about actual racists and sexists that they are less tolerant of. And in some cases, we're just talking about people with slightly different views on gender or on race-related political issues that aren't necessarily racist or sexist, but just are maybe unusual or outside of the political mainstream. And when young people are less tolerant of those people, those views don't necessarily get heard that might have some validity to them. They might not, but they might have validity to them as well.
I think that's right. And I think, there are certain things that could be said on a college campus that I think we would all agree should not be said, right? That they create an environment that is hostile, or in some cases, the communication is illegal, right? And we have clear definitions. Well, maybe not so clear, but we have some definitions of what that kind of communication would look like. But you're right that what happens is it becomes a justification for silencing anything that makes us uncomfortable, or anything that might make somebody else uncomfortable. So a lot of, I think about, discussions of affirmative action on campus. I teach public policy, and so I'm a policy person, and we ought to be able to look at those policies and say, are they working? Are they accomplishing what they should be accomplishing? Are they meeting the goals that we set out for them to meet? And I think students are very shy about talking about some of those issues because legitimate policy discourse and discussion can be seen as threatening, hostile, and racist to some students. And so I think you're right. It just becomes very difficult. And the question is, who gets to decide? Who gets to decide if you are going to start limiting expression? Who gets to decide what is and what is not acceptable, and what criteria are they using?
Sure. It's a very dangerous path to go down, and affirmative action is exactly the type of issue that I have in mind with the types of statements I just made. But one of the things you said in your article is that Americans have not, rather than becoming more tolerant, they've instead shifted their dislike towards new groups. And you just mentioned some groups that Americans, young people in particular, are less tolerant towards now. But at the same time, there are, in fact, some groups that young people are more tolerant towards than previous generations. So what are those groups?
Well, I think you see, and I'm gonna qualify this in a minute here. I think you see more acceptance and more general positive attitudes towards groups that were traditionally marginalized. Like the big growth in acceptance is towards it has to do with sexuality and gay rights. And so you see much more acceptance of homosexuality, for example. but I wouldn't call that tolerance. And the reason I wouldn't call it tolerance is because of the definition we used at the beginning. Tolerance isn't a measure of who you like and who your friends are. Tolerance is a measure of how you treat the people that you find threatening. And so the fact that we no longer find those groups threatening, or that young people no longer find those groups threatening, that no longer becomes a measure of tolerance. And so one of the ways that we traditionally measure tolerance is we ask people to indicate which groups they find most dangerous. And so think about the groups that you most fundamentally dislike, and we can list them on a survey. You know, how do you feel about different ethnic groups? How do you feel about different religious groups? How do you feel about, radical Islamic Muslims, you know, preaching hatred of America? It's one of the questions that's used on some of the surveys. How do you feel about those groups? And then you take the person's least liked group. Who do you really, really fear or despise? And then your measure of tolerance is how you treat them, right? Tolerance is about how we treat our most fundamental political enemies.
So why have we seen this reversal of trend? Why are young people breaking the trend of increasing tolerance over time?
Well, I think the narrative about free speech and free expression and the values we used to assign to it has shifted and changed over time, such that they don't have a real understanding of where those values came from and why they were important. When we think about free expression and free speech, historically, it was used as a tool to free marginalized groups. It was used as, you know, without free speech and free expression and freedom of the press, the civil rights movement would never have been what it was. And so I think we have a generation who has lost some historical insight into the value that that has brought to marginalized communities. But I also think there's, you know, a number of other things going on. So in our public school systems, we have this growing emphasis on teaching children to be kind and nice. And I have kids in public schools. I am all supportive of teaching children to be kind and nice. But they also come out without an appreciation for free expression and how to talk to one another. The anti-bullying campaigns, while very useful in preventing bullying, have a side effect. And that side effect is teaching them that words are harmful and words hurt and words need to be controlled. And so they're coming to college. You know, a lot of people want to blame higher ed for this trend, and we're really seeing it, you know, with people coming in. This isn't something that's happening at college. We aren't reversing it there, and you should argue that, you know, in a free marketplace of ideas, a college education should free people from these types of restrictions on their thinking. But they're bringing it with them from K through 12. I also think that there's a lot going on in society in terms of social media, where people are just becoming more and more politically isolated in their own silos. And so the research in political psychology and in social psychology shows that in order to be tolerant, in order to really be comfortable with hearing ideas that you disagree with, you have to have some experience with that. And the truth is we're having less experience with that, that people are selectively tuning in more and more to those things that they already agree with. And I think this is why the heterodoxacademy.org organization and the people that are involved with that are so concerned about viewpoint diversity on campus. Because if you are not exposed to those alternative views and you don't have experience with that diversity of viewpoints, you don't feel well equipped to handle it.
Sure. And of course, we'll link to heterodoxacademy.org at the show notes page, which is wakeupcallpodcast.com/tolerant. But in your article, one term that you use that might be unfamiliar to a lot of people is the new left. And a person that you reference, who likewise is probably unfamiliar to many people, is Herbert Marcuse. So what is the new left, and who was Herbert Marcuse, and how did they fit into the issue of tolerance and intolerance?
Right. So, you know, and you have to be careful here, because what I've argued is that the ideas that were put forth by the new left, those sort of justifications for intolerance seem to have taken root. That doesn't mean that young people that are applying them have gone off and studied Marcuse, right? That's one of the questions I always get. But wait, they have no idea who this is. But that doesn't mean that that narrative and that explanation for how we communicate with each other or should communicate with each other hasn't permeated our society. So Marcuse actually argued for an intolerance of intolerance, right? And that became the paradox of tolerance. The idea being that if you were tolerant towards those who were intolerant, then you were promoting intolerance instead of tolerance. And so he argued that in order to produce a tolerant society, one actually had to shut down, silence, and be intolerant of those who would be intolerant of others. And so you get in this weird loop, right, where people have to be intolerant of intolerance, but who gets to define what is intolerance? And so I talk to students about these issues all the time, and I try to relay it in way, you know, kind of simplistic terms. And if you think about an argument between a very religious person and an atheist, both of those people would come into that argument thinking the other one was quite intolerant, right? So the atheist would think that the religious person is intolerant of their views and is oppressing them and shutting down atheism, and the religious person would think that the atheist is intolerant of their views, and if everybody gets to silence or be intolerant of all those they find to be promoting intolerance, everybody's silencing everyone, and that might be where we are today. But the argument that you hear, and you see it expressed by students and student newspapers. In my article, I link to a quote from a student in the Harvard Crimson, where they are really echoing this language, that in order to promote a just and peaceful and tolerant society, they cannot put up with words that would hurt other people, that would disenfranchise or marginalize people. And that is a new left concept. Yeah.
We do see this a lot on college campuses, protests and bans on campus speakers who the students claim are promoting hate speech or different civility codes and harassment policies that are on campus. And a lot of those things seem to be relatively new. But yeah, we definitely seem to see a kind of an impact on campus.
And I think there's a tendency among people that want to make campuses more welcoming and accepting and more diverse, I think there's a tendency to see those who are saying, wait a minute, we still need this free speech, right? This is a fundamental part of the educational mission and who we are. I think there's a tendency to see free speech advocates as people that are just promoting intolerance, that are justifying negative views, that are justifying sexism, that are justifying the things that we want to do away with on campus. And I think that's because this idea and this perspective from the new left has taken hold. And it's very different than a classical liberal approach to the issue, which says we're not okay with people being mean and hateful and nasty and discriminatory, but we don't counter that by silencing people. That just kind of drives it underground, and then it festers in the underground where you can't address it. The classical liberal approach is that you combat that kind of speech with more speech. And so we're not saying you have a free pass on a college campus to say whatever you want, and that you don't stand up to challenge. And, you know, what we're saying is that the classical liberal view and the way that the institutions of higher education were founded is on this view that when you experience or you encounter views that you find offensive, that you find repugnant, that you think are dangerous to society, you get to challenge them. You get to say why they're dangerous to society. And what we want to do is we want to empower people to do that. And I know that some people are less capable of doing that, and some groups have historically been less capable of doing that. But the goal is to empower them and others to challenge those views and bring them to light and expose them. And, you know, our goal in higher education should always be the search for truth, right? And you can't search for truth if you're silencing people that are bringing counter arguments to the table.
Sure. So what is the connection between intolerance and a social justice viewpoint or background?
you know, the first article I wrote on this on Heterodox Academy looked at the relationship between whether or not you would allow people to speak and whether or not you have this kind of social justice orientation, which I defined as believing that the government should get involved in helping people that are low income, helping racial minorities, that the government had a responsibility to help equalize, right, or assist those populations. And there was a correlation between whether or not you believe that the government had a responsibility to provide aid to low-income people and minorities, and whether or not you were intolerant. So people that promoted a government rule there were more likely to restrict the speech and freedom of others. And there I measure tolerance by whether or not you will allow the people that you most fundamentally despise or are afraid of to speak in public, to have a book published in their public library, and to teach college classes. And what we find is the lowest level of tolerance are towards professors and whether or not people with these ideas should be allowed to teach in college. And I think that's because we assume they're influencing the young minds and that would be very dangerous. But my later research finds a stronger correlation between something else that I actually find much more interesting. And that is that even with all the other variables in the model, even controlling for predictable, traditional predictors of tolerance like education and gender and ideology, the thing that keeps coming up as one of the strongest predictors is how informed you think you are about politics and government. So your confidence in your ability to enter into the political fray and hold your own and have an argument where you defend your viewpoints, that's a key predictor of tolerance. And people who think that they are less informed about politics and government than others are the least tolerant. So to me, this is an educational problem, right? We've steered away from teaching civics and teaching government. And the American Council of Trustees and Alumni does a big survey of liberal arts college, and they find that I think it's something like 18% require a course in American government. So I think these things are connected, and the less confident you are in your ability to bring arguments to the table because you know something about politics and government and can speak intelligently, the less confident you are, the more likely you are to just want to shut down the debate because you don't think the marketplace of ideas works, right? If you, I draw parallels between this and trade protectionism, right? So if we think about trading ideas like we do about trading goods, You have to have a fair marketplace. And if you don't believe that your product or your ideas can be defended and stand up to others, then you engage in protectionism, right? You shut down trade. And so I think that's what's happening in college campuses. I think a lot of it has to do with a lack of confidence in the ability of young people to defend their own political positions.
I think that's a great analogy, a great comparison. Are there any particular statistics or any other evidence that you can point to demonstrate the lack of what we might call ideological diversity on college campuses and in academia and higher education? Because I'm guessing that there are people listening to this who are not necessarily familiar with the sorts of things that go on college campuses. So what else can you draw on to demonstrate that?
There are studies and some posts by some of my colleagues on Heterodox Academy, but we have looked for decades at surveys of academics and self-reports of academics in terms of what they say their political ideology is. So this isn't something that we're just inferring. This isn't something we're picking up by reading the New York Times. There's actual survey evidence. People go out and they ask college professors, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? Are you a Libertarian? And in those surveys, it's just time after time after time again, the results are just overwhelmingly skewed towards the left, right? And this is what people are admitting to, right? And I think a lot of people think they're moderates when they're not, which we can talk about. So you probably even have an underreporting of liberal ideology on campus. But self-reported surveys of professors show that in some disciplines, 90% are liberal Democrats, and the others are moderates. In some disciplines, it's very, very hard to find somebody that says that they're a conservative.
Right, and there seems to be a much greater emphasis on finding professors and finding people in higher education who maybe look different, maybe come from a different background, maybe come from different sides of the globe and have completely different hometowns, but less of a focus on people with different views and different ideologies.
Right, and I think, you know, just to be clear, I find that diversity of background and experience that colleges seek, I find it very useful. And so I'm not opposed necessarily to a movement to diversify, but you have to think about how we justify that movement to diversify. And we do so by arguing that the reason why we want people of different racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, different genders, right, different sexualities, the reason why we want all those people in higher education is because we argue, and when I say we, I mean all of the institutions of higher education, but a lot of organizations, higher ed organizations, argue this, right? And the reason we argue that we want these people on campus is because we say students and others will learn from other people's experiences and other people's perspectives. So it's very odd to me that people can't apply that towards wanting people that have different viewpoints, right? Because the whole argument for why we want people that have different racial, ethnic, and religious backgrounds is we want those rich viewpoints to enliven our communities. So the fact that that can't be applied towards, hey, and maybe we should have some conservatives, it suggests to me that there is some protectionism going on, right? That trade protectionism. We don't really want different viewpoints here. We want certain viewpoints because we have some issues and some agendas that we're trying to promote. And to the extent that people can come in and promote those by bringing their experiences to the table, we're very accepting of that. But when we get real challenge to those ideas, when we get real diversity of opinion that we would really learn from, it becomes threatening, right? That's what political tolerance is all about. We find people that oppose our ideas strongly to be threatening.
And where can we see this headed in the future, and what do you think some solutions are in higher education and society in general?
I think in the past, people arguing about conservative rights on campus, people arguing that conservatives are not represented on campus, have done so from a political position and have done so because they feel that they need to compete for influencing the young people of society. Part of the reason I joined the group at Heterodox Academy is because these are political scientists and psychologists who aren't really looking at it from that angle. It's a pretty diverse group of people. And what they're saying is, wait a minute, there's evidence that the lack of dialogue between people of different viewpoints, the lack of incorporation of different perspectives is harming all of us. So this isn't about a left-right winning, right? This isn't about some zero-sum game where we're going to put conservatives on campus and that's going to make conservative ideas win. No, what we're saying is that the dialogue, the debate, getting people out of their ideologically isolated silos is good for everybody, and it benefits liberals, and it benefits conservatives, and it benefits moderates. And so I think that the people involved in that project have been pretty successful in conveying that and saying that this is about the quality of our work. This is about the quality of our teaching. This is about how students learn to engage in disagreements. And it's useful for everyone to have some diversity of viewpoint. And so I think if we continue to be successful in changing that narrative and not making it just this battle between liberals and conservatives, but saying, you know, let's look psychologically at the evidence and the data that shows that we all benefit and we all learn and we become better people when we are exposed to people that don't think like us. And I think that that change is going to, I hope, resonate better, and you'll see some productive responses.
Sure. And one final question for you, and this is an unusual way of posing a question for me, but the way you sum up your in this article, and again, the article is called How Marcuse Made Today's Students Less Tolerant Than Their Parents, But the final two sentences here are very interesting and thought-provoking, so I want to read those and have you comment. When colleges fail to represent the full measure of political ideas, students are less likely to learn to tolerate those unlike themselves. This, combined with the New Left's legacy of liberating tolerance, creates an environment that values anger and orthodoxy over inquiry and debate. Now, we've been, of course, touching on these themes and these ideas over the course of this interview, but at the end, when you say that this all creates an environment that values anger and orthodoxy over inquiry and debate, it's a very powerful and strong way of expressing some of what we've been discussing. So can you comment on what you say at the very end of this article?
Well, I think that's what we're seeing on a lot of college campuses right now, is that students are going to great lengths to shut down those who would disagree with them. And so you've seen cases where presidents have been ousted and students have called for drastic measures because of viewpoints on campus that were, in some cases, quite offensive. You know, objectively speaking, everyone would agree that this was, you know, not a nice thing to say. But they want the university to provide a very protective environment where no one's exposed to any of that. And that's not reality, and that's not the way the world works. And so we're not really preparing students to go out into the world if we've created this little protective cocoon where they're not going to encounter anything that they find objectionable. And as I said before, that doesn't mean that colleges should welcome objectionable behavior, but there's a big difference between approaching somebody who says something that you find offensive and talking to them and, you know, banning them or forbidding them or firing them. And so I have conversations with students all the time. You know, I've become somewhat known as the free speech person on campus. I teach a course on free speech. And when students get into trouble on campus, as they do on every campus, for something they said, and they come and talk to me, I say, I want you to understand something. I believe you had the right to say that, and I will defend your right to say that. But that doesn't mean it was the right thing to say, right? And so we need to look at this from, as educators, from a perspective of teaching students how to dialogue with people. And what we're seeing instead on campus is just this movement to shut down, to silence, and to run off of campus anyone who says something that might be offensive. And if we're trying to educate those people, what we've probably done is quite frankly, entrench them in their viewpoints, right? Because people do not respond well to punitive measures and that kind of heavy hand, and that we should really look at it as educators and teaching students how to dialogue with each other in a way that's productive and useful to society.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time and for joining us today. If someone is interested in learning more about the sorts of things we've been discussing during this interview, you know, what readings and resources do you recommend they take a look at?
Like I said, there's a lot of blog posts and a lot of new research that's going up at Heterodox Academy. So I think that the blog posts there are not just blog posts, but they're linking to some of the most interesting research. And so I would recommend that people take a look at that site. My second article there, which I actually like a little bit better than what we're talking about, is titled Trade Protectionism in the Marketplace of Ideas. And that's where I talk about this, you know, this vulnerability and the feeling of vulnerability of being able to defend your perspective, fueling intolerance. But there's a lot of good research there and a lot of links to other research as well that you can follow there.
Okay, great. And what are the best ways to follow your work in particular?
That's a really good question. I tend to put things on my website at Elizabethtown College, and so there are periodic updates there, although I confess to not update them as often as I should. So I also write a monthly column for the Lancaster Sunday News, and so people can follow my work at the Lancaster Sunday News site.
Okay, very good. All right, well, I want to remind everybody to go to the show notes page for this episode at wakeupcallpodcast.com/tolerant. And there will be links there to heterodoxacademy.org, to the article that we've been discussing, How Marcuse Made Today's Students Less Tolerant Than Their Parents, to the article that you just mentioned, about trade protectionism in the marketplace of ideas, and also links to your Elizabethtown College page and the two books that we mentioned in the introduction. So every resource related to this episode that we've mentioned over the course of this interview, there will be a link to it at wakeupcallpodcast.com/tolerance. And I want to encourage everybody to sign up for our email list while they're on our website, and also to subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or Stitcher or your preferred podcatcher so that you can stay up to date on what's going on with the show and make sure to never miss an episode. And April, thank you very much for coming on to the show today to discuss this very important topic with us from a viewpoint that you probably won't hear in most media outlets. So thank you very much for clarifying some terms for us and helping us to take a look at what's going on with tolerance and young people in college campuses and tolerance across society, across larger swaths of society as well. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Wake Up Call podcast.
If you would like to listen to more episodes, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or subscribe on Stitcher, and check out our website at wakeupcallpodcast.com.
There you will find show notes pages and comment sections dedicated to the show. You can also email us at contact@wakeupcallpodcast.com if you're interested in being interviewed for the show or have any other suggestions.
Thank you.